Yesterday, a 400-foot rocket built by, the richest man on Earth, it just, well, it choked on the launch pad.
Yeah, a complete and total shutdown.
Right. I mean, the engines misfired, the safety systems screamed, and the whole behemoth just had to be halted. But then, fast forward just 24 hours to today.
To a very different outcome, yeah.
Exactly. A unicorn startup,
Yeah.
one you have probably never even heard of, just effortlessly launched a rocket into orbit. They even carried a little postcard. It's like
Ugh.
the entire monopoly on the future just shifted in a single weekend.
It really did. And it's not just happening up in space either.
No.
No, I mean, it is happening right in our living rooms. It's happening in our pockets. We are basically looking at a weekend where the foundational rules of, who controls the future are being completely rewritten.
Well, welcome to this deep dive. If you are joining us to get a handle on where the world is heading, you are definitely in the right place.
Absolutely.
Today, we are sifting through the Good Morning Saturday Tech and Space wrap-up from today, July 18th, 2026. And we've got a wild stack of sources.
We really do.
We're covering that massive rocket launch in India, the death of a historic disc manufacturing plant in Austria, a video game sale that generated almost $1 billion in just 2 weeks, and some incredibly aggressive smartphone price drops.
Right. And on paper, I mean, those sound like four completely isolated industries,
Right.
right?
Rockets and video games.
Yeah. But when you look at the actual mechanics of what is happening in each of these stories, they are all symptoms of the exact same massive paradigm shift.
The shift in how we access the future. Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with the ultimate boundary of access, right?
Yes.
Space.
Space.
Because
Ugh.
what happened at the Satish Dhawan Space Center in India today is frankly staggering.
It was a completely textbook launch. So at 12:05 p.m. local time, Skyroot Aerospace launched their Vikram 1 rocket.
And this thing is big, right?
Oh, yeah. It is a 7-story tall, 4-stage rocket.
Yeah.
And they deployed their payloads directly into low Earth orbit. And by doing that, I mean they made India only the third country in the world, right behind the US and China, to possess a fully private orbital launch capability.
That is just wild. I was reading the coverage of this, the Agamemnon mission, and it looked completely effortless. Just this clean orange smoke trail off the pad.
Yeah, a beautiful launch.
But I keep wondering, how on earth does a startup from Hyderabad pull off something that SpaceX stumbled on literally yesterday?
It's a great question.
Because, I mean, the SpaceX Starship Flight 13, it suffered a T-0 abort.
Yeah.
And just that we're totally clear for everyone listening, a T-0 means the absolute exact millisecond the rocket is supposed to leave the
Yeah,
pad, right?
correct. Yeah. A TRO abort means the countdown literally reached zero. The command to launch was given, the ignition sequence actually started, and then.
Computers just scream stop.
Exactly. The automated computers caught a catastrophic error and slammed the brakes before the launch clamps even release.
Then that error was with the Raptor engines, right? I saw that 4 out of the 33 engines on that super heavy booster just failed to fire.
Right, four of them didn't ignite.
But here's what I don't get. SpaceX has been launching rockets for, what, over 2 decades now? Why is it so unbelievably difficult to get 33 engines to just light at the same time?
Well, it is a phenomenal engineering challenge, mostly because of the fuel and just the sheer physics of combustion.
Okay, break that down for me.
Sure. So these Raptor engines, they run on a mix of subcooled liquid methane and liquid oxygen. When you try to ignite 33 of them simultaneously, you aren't just, lighting a fire.
Right.
You are creating these massive, violent acoustic vibrations. The sound waves and the pressure waves bouncing off that concrete launch pad are so intense that they can actually disrupt the fuel flow in the neighboring engines.
Wait, really? So the noise from one engine can literally choke the engine right next to it.
Essentially, yes. If even a few engines are slightly out of sync with their fuel pressure, that acoustic energy can literally tear the rocket apart, or it can cause a sympathetic explosion.
Oh, wow. So it's not just like conducting a symphony orchestra where, say, a few violins are out of tune.
No, not at all.
It's like if those violins were playing so wildly out of tune that the sound waves started shattering the instruments of everyone sitting next to them.
That is, yes, that's actually a highly accurate way to look at it.
And the conductor, the automatic safety system, has to shut the whole concert down so the stage doesn't evaporate.
Exactly. And what's fascinating here is that this is exactly why the Skyroot launch today is so critical for the global market.
Right, because SpaceX is a giant.
Right. SpaceX went public last month in June 2026. They are an absolute titan. But space cannot be a monopoly. What Skyroot just proved today is that you don't need to be an established American or Chinese giant to build reliable, practical orbital technology.
They are proving that the private sector, like normal startups, can bring actual competition to space.
Yes, and competition dictates reduced launch costs. It means an increase in how frequently we can send payloads up, especially into low Earth orbit, or LEO.
Which, okay, this is where this directly impacts you, the person listening to us right now. LEO isn't just some abstract scientific zone, right?
Yeah, no, not at all. LEO is the zone roughly 160 to 2,000 kilometers above the Earth's surface. That is the commercial gold rush right now.
The gold rush, why? Because it's close.
Exactly. The massive advantage of LEO is that it is close enough to Earth to allow for high-speed, low-latency communication. It's where the International Space Station sits, sure, but more importantly for you and me, it's where the satellite constellations that power global internet like Starlink operate.
Ah, I see.
So by reliably reaching LEO, Skyroot is democratizing access to the very infrastructure that powers our entire digital lives.
Okay, so private companies like Skyroot are building the orbital infrastructure. They're launching the literal servers in the sky.
Yes, the servers in the sky.
But here's the thing about servers. Owning the servers gives a company ultimate leverage over what you and I can actually access on a daily basis.
That's very true.
And we are seeing that exact same power grab happen right now in our own living rooms.
Ah, you're talking about the Sony announcement.
Yes. The death of physical media. Sony made it official on July 1st. By January 2028, they are entirely ceasing production of Blu-ray discs for new PlayStation games.
Complete shutdown of the physical format.
Everything is going digital.
And, you know, the detail from the report that really illustrates the finality of this is what is happening at Sony's Thalgo factory in Austria.
Oh, yeah, I read about that.
Yeah, this is a facility that has manufactured 24 billion discs over the years.
Wait, 24 billion? That's insane. And half of those are probably just unplayed copies of FIFA sitting on shelves in thrift stores somewhere.
Honestly, it wouldn't be surprising at all. But that massive factory is already being gutted. It's being converted into a micro-optics lab. The era of the disc is just over.
Now, okay, I will play devil's advocate for a second.
Go for it.
I totally understand the convenience of going digital. You don't have to find physical shelf space, you never lose the disc, and you don't have to wait in line at midnight in the freezing cold for a new release. You just download it.
Right, it's fictionless.
But here's where it gets really interesting. And honestly, it alarms me a bit. If I buy a physical disc, I can lend it to my neighbor, I can trade it in, I can sell it at a garage sale in 10 years.
You actually own it.
Right. With this Sony move, aren't we just handing a complete monopoly to these digital storefronts? I mean, I'm not buying a game anymore. I'm just renting a temporary license on Sony's servers, right?
You are absolutely right. And the thing is, this is entirely by design.
Of course it is.
Slate actually ran a great piece analyzing this. They pointed out that by killing the physical disc, the digital storefront becomes the single exclusive purchasing location.
To no used games.
Exactly. There is no used game market to drive prices down. Sony or Microsoft or Valve Wigger, they gain completely unchecked control over pricing.
Wow. And we know this transition didn't just happen overnight, right? They've been planning this.
No, the writing has been on the wall for a while. The Verge reported that Sony actually stopped producing consumer recordable Blu-rays back in mid-2024.
Oh, I totally missed that.
Yeah, the profitability of the physical medium just vanished. But if you want to understand why companies are so desperate to force you into a digital-only ecosystem, you really just have to look at the PC gaming market.
Right, the Steam sale.
Yes, the Steam summer sale that just wrapped up on July 9th.
The numbers and the sources on this are just staggering.
They generated approximately $876 million in gross merchandise value over a 14-day period.
Almost $1 billion.
Right.
In 2 weeks. Yeah. Just from digital game downloads.
It's incredible.
It's not just the amount of money that fascinates me. It's the psychology behind how they extracted it. Because Steam used to do this very differently, didn't they?
They did. For years, the defining feature of a Steam sale was the flash sale.
Oh, man. I remember those.
Right. A game might be 40% off, but if you waited and checked the store at, say, 2:00 a.m., it might suddenly drop to 80% off for, like, 4 hours.
I remember doing exactly that. It was exhausting. You were constantly trying to game the system, terrified of buying something on Tuesday that might be cheaper on Thursday.
Which is exactly why Valve abandoned that model. It created this immense cognitive load for the buyer. and it triggered loss aversion.
Right, because you didn't want to miss the better deal.
Exactly. People would wait to see if a price dropped lower, and often they would just forget to buy the game entirely. They'd walk away.
So what did they do for this 2026 sale?
Now, the discounts are entirely fixed for the full 2 weeks. You see a massive title like the Silent Hill 2 Remake at 60% off for $27.99, or Red Dead Redemption 2 at 67% off for $19.79.
And it stays that price the whole time. And the sources mentioned they use something called Steamworks rules to cap the discounts.
Yes, Steamworks is basically the back-end platform and rulebook that developers use to publish on Steam. Valve instituted a rule capping catalog discounts at 90%.
Wow, 90%.
Though exceptions are occasionally made that hit 95%. But the real genius of the fixed discount is the psychological relief it gives the buyer.
Because there's no FOMO.
Right. When you know the price of Red Dead Redemption 2 will not change for 14 days, you just buy it immediately.
Thus creating the legendary gamer pile of shame.
Yes.
Just buying a dozen games on sale that you know you will never actually have time to play.
Exactly. They engineered a perfectly optimized digital machine to extract that $876 million simply by removing the friction of waiting.
Man, look, it all comes back to leverage, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Skyroot is launching the servers into space. Sony and Steam are forcing us to buy digital licenses stored on those servers.
Yeah, that's the ecosystem.
So if we are completely trapped looking through a digital window to access our entertainment, the physical glass of that window, our screens, our hardware, becomes literally the only thing we actually own.
A great point.
Which brings up an incredibly fierce debate in our sources today. How much can these companies actually charge us for that glass?
Right. And we have two massive tech companies grappling with the hardware pricing dilemma right now. And they are taking entirely opposite approaches, Nintendo and Google.
Okay, let's look at Nintendo first. Because the industry sources are leaking that Nintendo is in intense internal debates about releasing a Switch 2 OLED model.
Right. So to give this a little context, Nintendo unveiled the base model Switch 2 back in April 2026.
Yep, the big reveal.
And it officially launches on September 1st, 2026, with a retail price of $500.
Which is steep.
It is. And that base model uses an LCD screen. What they are debating now is a potential OLED version featuring a full HD 1920 by 1080 resolution using a rigid panel supplied by Samsung Display.
And when would that come out?
If approved, we are looking at a late 2027 or 2028 release.
But the pricing mechanics here are just brutal.
Right.
I mean, when I first read this, I thought of a car dealership trying to force a luxury trim package on a buyer in a terrible economy.
That's a good comparison.
But it's deeper than that, isn't it? It's about the bill of materials.
Mm-hmm.
Consumers are already staring at a $500 price tag for a handheld console. If you add the premium cost of an OLED panel, you hit a massive psychological pricing wall.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you can see exactly why Nintendo is sweating. They rely heavily on their own historical data.
Right, what worked before.
The original Switch launched in 2017. 4 years later, in October 2021, they introduced the Switch 1 OLED. It was a monumental success.
And remember, everyone wanted one.
Because it triggered a massive second wave of sales. Millions of people who already owned a Switch happily paid for the upgrade just to get that larger, vibrant 7-inch screen.
But the original Switch was only $300.
Mm-hmm.
Adding $50 for an OLED screen on top of that is an easy mental hurdle for the consumer.
Precisely. The math changes completely when your starting baseline is $500. Digital Foundry noted there is no mention of a size increase for the Switch 2 OLED, just the jump to a 1080p panel.
So it's not even a bigger screen this time.
Right. And Nintendo makes a significant portion of its revenue on hardware margins. They need the console to be profitable on day one. So Samsung is pushing them to buy these rigid OLED screens, but passing that cost to a consumer who is already paying $500, it's incredibly risky.
They're walking a very narrow tightrope between visual fidelity and competitive pricing, which is such a massive contrast to what Google is doing right now with the Pixel 9a. While Nintendo is terrified of charging a premium for a better screen, Google is out here dropping the ultimate cheat code for smartphone buyers.
The current aggressive pricing on the Pixel 9a is quite remarkable, really.
It's in free fall. The phone launched at $499. It just hit a record low of $349 on Amazon and Best Buy.
Unbelievable.
That is a 30% discount on a phone that has flagship level specs. I mean, for $349, you are getting a battery that lasts over 30 hours, wireless charging, 120 hertz display, 7 years of guaranteed software updates. Well, guaranteed updates. And it just got the Android 17 update.
Right, it's packed with features.
It even has an IP68 rating,
which is incredibly rare at the sub $400 price point. For those unfamiliar, IP68 is an ingress protection rating. The 6 means it is completely dust tight, and the 8 means it can survive continuous immersion in water.
You usually only see that on $1,000 phones.
Right.
And a 120 hertz display means a screen refreshes 120 times a second, so scrolling through your social media just feels buttery smooth. It's an insane value.
It really is.
But here's what I want to push back on. The official narrative in the sources is that Google is just clearing out inventory ahead of the Pixel 10a unveiling in February 2027.
That's the official line, yes.
But I don't buy that it's just a warehouse clearance, a 30% discount. Are they panicking? Are they taking a massive loss on the hardware just to stop people from moving to competitors in the AI space?
That is a very sharp deduction, and it gets right to the heart of Google's strategy. Google isn't a hardware company in the way Nintendo is.
Right.
Nintendo needs to make money when you buy the physical plastic and glass. Google views the smartphone simply as a vehicle. It is a loss leader for them.
So they are genuinely willing to lose money on the phone itself?
Absolutely, or at least just break even. They are heavily subsidizing the cost of that IP68 rating and that 120 hertz screen because the real prize is your long-term digital loyalty.
The ecosystem.
Exactly. If you buy a Pixel for $349, you are locked into their ecosystem. You are using their search engine. You are integrating with their cloud storage. And most importantly right now, you are feeding data into their AI models.
Ah, the AI data, of course.
They are democratizing premium hardware features because the hardware is just the bait.
The phone is the bait, and the ecosystem is the trap. It's a total inversion of Nintendo's problem.
Very much so.
Visual fidelity versus competitive pricing for Nintendo. But for Google, it's hardware margins versus ecosystem dominance.
It perfectly illustrates how flexible the price of the physical key can be, depending on what the company really wants from you.
It really is all connected.
Yeah.
When we step back and look at this entire stack of sources from today, July 18th, 2026, the through line is just undeniable. The rules of who controls access to the future are being rapidly rewritten.
We are watching Skyroot prove that private startups can reliably build the infrastructure of low Earth orbit, even while the legacy giants stumble.
We are watching Sony and Valve completely eradicate the physical media market, forcing us all to buy digital licenses that they can completely control the price of.
And we are watching hardware giants like Nintendo and Google completely rethink what you are actually willing to pay just to hold the glass that connects you to those digital storefronts.
And if you are listening right now, these aren't just corporate boardroom strategies. These maneuvers dictate your daily life.
They really do.
They determine how much you are going to pay for your next smartphone. They dictate whether your internet connection from space is run by a monopoly or a competitive market. They decide whether you are legally allowed to hand a video game to your best friend after you finish playing it.
We are transitioning fully into a digital private sector-led future. And while the conveniences are incredibly seductive, from lightning-fast game downloads to a water-resistant phone for $350, there is a profound vulnerability baked into this new structure.
Yeah, there is.
Which raises an essential question I think we all need to consider as we watch physical ownership disappear.
What's that?
As everything we consume moves onto private digital platforms, from the literal orbital satellites that transmit our data to the digital servers that hold our entire cultural gaming libraries, what happens when the companies holding those digital keys go out of business?
Oh.
If there are no physical disks and no localized servers, who preserves human history when the platform dies?
Man, that is a heavy, essential thought to leave on. When we give up the physical key, we are basically trusting someone else to never change the locks.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us as we unpack the forces shaping our world today. We love taking these complex, overlapping changes and figuring out what they actually mean for your wallet, your internet, and your entertainment. Stay curious, keep questioning what you actually own, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.